everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet a man who has walked his own path in life and has agreed to share it with us. Today's guest is no different. I am very pleased to introduce you to William P. Dunn, the fourth William. I'm hoping I can call you Bill. Welcome.
Yes, Pam, Bill is perfect.
Okay. Now,
as long as you don't say Billy, that's what Dad called me.
I will not say Billy. We're going to stick with Bill.
Thank you.
Now, Bill, you spent 20 years working on Wall Street, became a financial advisor in northern New Jersey. And, you know, from the outside looking in, you were absolutely living the American dream. And at one point, you had a solid career, a stunning wife, two lovely daughters, and now what we're talking about today is Sandy's gift, walking with the light. So things kind of shifted at some point. Talk about that for a moment.
Yes, they did. We, you know, look, I'm just a kid, as I wrote in the beginning of the book. I had a paper route. I grew up shoveling horse manure. I became a human mule, a caddy, as they call it. I tied trout flies professionally. I could have gone that venue. My father had a talk with me as a young boy at 17. He said, Billy, I was convinced I wanted to be a forest ranger. He said, well, if that's really what you want to do, we'll get you to college. And he says, you will live where you want to fish and you can't afford a fishing pole. So as I wrote the beginning of the book in the prelude, I wound up in the canyons of Wall Street rather than the canyons out west of my dreams, okay?
That's
basically it. That's the 1.5-page introduction to my young life up to age, you know, going to college.
Well, that's pretty impressive. That's a very brief, condensed introduction. Your book, though, Sandy's Gift, Walking in the Light, the story actually begins in so many ways on a Saturday evening in March of 1985. What was going on that Saturday evening? Why was that so momentous and memorable?
Well, I went to a party with a couple of friends. One of my friends said, I worked in Manhattan. I met this gentleman who lived in Morristown. We chased skirts together, you know, and his parents were snowbirds living in Florida in the winter. And he would move into his parents' house because they didn't want it basically empty for the winter. And, you know, it was over in Morris Township, pretty big size house, you know, upper middle class area. And I arrived with three of my friends that evening about 10 o'clock. I had two cases of beer on my shoulder, and I think I had three things of Jack Daniels in my left hand. And I walked in to this party. Well, my friend said, bring stuff. I was like, okay. So, well, you never know. You know, it's always better to bring a gift. So I walked in and I was the last one in my group of four, and I locked in, and there was this woman, and it was Sandy, with these beautiful red hair and blue eyes. I'd never been attracted to a redhead, but there was one problem. She was with another guy.
Oh, rude.
So as I write in the book, we kept doing this eyeball glance all night long, and basically before the end of the evening was done, I got her phone number, and at the end of the evening, I met some other woman, a blonde, who basically was like saying, come on, take me home. My friends looked in disbelief as I said no. And then my one buddy says to me, you know, you had that redhead looking all night. What'd you do? And you didn't think about it. I said, hold on, let me show you a card. He goes, who's that? I go, it's the redhead. She goes, how'd you get it? And I go, it's just sheer luck. And as I say, had I gone the other route, life, I think, is somewhat preordained. Just this is my personal belief, Pam, is that if I had taken the route with the blonde and not the route with the redhead, who knows where life would go.
It would have been very different,
mm-hmm,
in all likelihood.
Correct. So the beginning of the book actually is four parts. It's called One, Building a Life Together. Part two is called 160 Days, from when school ended in 2006 till Sandy's passing. Part three is called Hocus Pocus. Then I have an epilogue at the back, which is about 10 or 12 pages long. And then I have five appendices, which go about what they do is they describe what was going beyond my back as I was trying to reach out and get help for my late wife.
All right. Let's talk about really the beginning of the marriage. Physically, she was absolutely stunning. It was a wonderful match. You got along so well together, and you had hopes and dreams and plans for a future together forever.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I look back at my life and I'm going, I was very, very blessed. You know, I was just the kid who worked his tail off, you know, and really some events started to train. I look back as I had an editor go through this, and I wanted a woman editor, and she wrote, she said, what you went through from 2001 through 2006 in that 5-year time frame, you know, loss of parents on both sides. I talked to Tragedy about 9/11, how I could have been working there that day. All these events, and she's like, you know, it was bing, 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 getting hit in the teeth, just as our lives were just about starting to be completely ready to go flying. You follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Does that make any sense?
Yes.
As a family, I would say not financially because we'd already achieved that, but more or less on, okay, now we're at the ready, it's called coast time. I don't have to work so hard. We have no debt. I lived debt-free. I'd had for many years, and it was just like, okay, now let's just get through the kids through high school and get out of New Jersey because it's become a sewage as far as I'm concerned as a state. And after what happened to my family, I will not set foot there. I won't buy a pack of bubble gum up there to support the public employees. To do so would be paying a sales tax. So that's my answer. I don't go there. I don't wish to. Got it? And some may or may not agree with it, but I have my right. And I put my money where my mouth is, and I'm not going to back down on that one.
Well, Ida, you sound very clear, very angry, but we'll get to that.
No, I'm over it now. You know,
yeah?
Just so, most of the way, yes.
Okay.
Most of the way.
Well, from 2001 to 2006, what happened in 2006?
Well, in 2006, Sandy passed away from a suicide, unfortunately. But let me go through 01. My father became ill prior to that with cancer. He passed away in June. My uncle passed away in March. I could have been working back at Cantor Fitzgerald, where I worked for a period of time on Wall Street, because a gentleman from town wanted me to go there. I did a thing called basis trading, which was just math. All it was doing futures against the Board of Trade futures against cash contracts of bonds. It's just math. It was very simple for me.
Okay.
Numbers are easy. Okay. When you add letters, I don't get it. My daughter, my engineering daughter does. Don't ask me how.
Okay.
So on that day of 9/11, I knew well over 50 people that perished that day. There were people that I worked
people.
With that I knew very well and liked. There were some I didn't care for, but no American deserved to die that way as far as I was concerned. Okay. And it got me thinking about a lot of things. And we had gotten ready to sell our house, move into my mother-in-law's place because her Alzheimer's had taken hold worse and we had to take care of her. I had suggested placing her into an institution, and my wife wanted no part of that. So when we got there, it's in the book, it got worse. After a year and a half, we had her institutionalized a year later. So we lost Sandy's mom in 03, okay, in the fall. In a few months later, and we were working on the horse farm, basically getting it ready to go, and it was moving along pretty good. And then in the spring of 2004, my mother took a fall, broke her leg. Well, long story short, it turned out it was cancer. She had cancer of the breast and the brain, and she died on my wife's birthday on May of 05. Mm. Okay. I'm now I'm the executive of an estate. Or execute, whatever you call that.
Executive.
I've got to handle the estate. We're still working on my wife's place, getting it up in order. We've got children. They're, you know, at fifth grade now and eighth grade, and life is going good. And just, you know how it is. You know, when you have children that age, your life revolves around them getting to what they got to do.
Absolutely.
So it's just, you know, where can I drive you to? Where do I pick you up? You know, it's just the way it works. Every parent that goes through this stage. And it gets worse when they're just before they can drive because they want to go everywhere. So long story short was in 2005, took a family vacation. We went down to Lexington, Kentucky, which was a trip that Sandy had done with her parents. And she talked about going, so I said, well, let's go. So we booked this trip. We go down to Lexington, Kentucky. We see all the horse farms. We go to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge, and do the theme parks there, Dollywood and all that. We come back, and we come back on a Thursday night from that trip. In August of 2005. The next day, we drive out to Long Island, to the North Shore. Now, it's four-plus hours to get there because you got to circumvent New York and go through two bridges or two tunnels. It's just the way it works. And we got to this hotel called Santorini's, which my wife had booked, and about 30 members of the family were staying there. And she got this very peculiar look on her face. I'll never forget it. And she's like, we can't stay here. This is a mafia place. And there were some Greek Renaissance statues and things like that. And I'm like, Sandy, everybody else is here. Knock it off. And she kept doing this. So we finally went out, Pam, to go for lunch with the children. And we're in Greenport, the next town east of there. And we're on a place on the water overlooking the Long Island Sound, very pretty place. And we order our meals, and I look at my wife, and the next thing I see, she is bright red, the color of her coral blouse. And the next thing I say, you were right. Well, about 3 minutes of that, she starts sweating profusely.
Oh, my.
And I said, let's take a walk outside. I said, Sandy, let's get to the doctor. What's going on? And she discloses to me. She says, well, I'm starting to go through the change of life. I said, have you seen the doctor? She goes, yes. I said, well, listen, when you get home, go take that drug Premarin. I don't care if it's from horse falls or whatever. It'll take care of these issues. And for a year, she lied to me that she was seeing doctors. I had no idea. I'm closing out the estate. I'm busier than heck. I come home every day. I work on the horse farm for 3 hours. Then it's mom's house and, you know, just the normal things and doing the kid things. So in the summer, in the new year, in January, it was either late January or February, my oldest daughter calls me and says, Dad, come home. Mom's acting really strange. And when I get home, I said, I can't. I'm at work. I get home, and my wife had broken the door to my daughter's bedroom. They had an argument. Jennifer locked the door. Her mother kept trying to get in and used the push pin and broke the door down, basically.
That sounds really scary.
Well, you know, and I'm like, and I get home, and I'm like, what's going on? And everything's normal, complete, as you and I are talking. So I kind of brushed it off, okay? The same thing happened again in May. I got home. This time I had to replace the door. I mean, they were the hollow doors that you put in, you know, from Home Depot. They weren't expensive. So I did it. And then school ended. So, and I just, our book describes our lives, which were quite normal, Pam, for quite a long time.
Yes. Just,
everything was going well. And then when school ended that year, Jennifer got work papers, but she would come home and I was getting phone calls. Mom's doing it. And what? She's acting weird. So, you know, I was like, this happened a couple times. And then finally about right after the 4th of July, Jenny called me about the third time on this. I said, that's it. I got in the car. I drove home. I'm like, what's going on? And her behavior was fine. And as I describe in a book, it was like a light switch would go on or off. Okay. 1 minute's fine. The next it's not. About a month later, let's see, Jenny's birthday was July 20th. On the 19th, we sold my mother's house. My brother and sister came up. Sandy's behavior was very odd that day because normally I was out of the house at, you know, 7:45 and home at 5:30 at night. And she's insisting we just sold her house. I'm like, Sandy, how can we sell the house? It's your name only. You know, she was just, her behavior was boom. And I just saw this for a brief period of time. The next night, she wouldn't go out to my daughter's birthday party, which was basically just the family, and stayed home. And years later, my daughter said to me, my oldest told me, because I didn't know this for years, that she said that Mom said Dad was going to have her poisoned at the restaurant. Okay?
Okay.
And my daughter was only 14 when this was going on. My youngest was 12.
So this is really scary for your
this
children.
Is, well, you know, and I didn't know this, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, look, I was the guy who got home. I'm outside working on the horse farm for 3 hours till dark. I eat my dinner and go out and work. This is what I did. And it was, and I, as I wrote in the book, I did it because I enjoyed it. You know, when you sit and look at numbers all day, doing the physical work is good. It clears your mind.
Absolutely.
Got it? And listen, I'm a kid who started shoveling horse manure at a young age. So, you know.
you had experience.
Yes. And I got to do it again after she passed, trust me, for 5.5 years. So anyway, what happened was a couple weeks later, I said, and things were getting peculiar. And I said to her, I said, Sandy, what is the doctor saying? Oh, well, you know, I said, what about the medications you're on? She's telling me she's on medications. I didn't look because I assumed she was. So it turned out she wasn't. So what happens was we go up about 2 weeks before she was involuntarily taken away in a straitjacket. We're going to go to the Catskills. We had a 40-foot trailer with a deck off of it. I called it the Hilton on Wheels, okay? You know, AC, the whole bit up on the Beaver Hill River because we trout fished. And that's part of the book also, as you know. And some very spiritual things happen up there.
Yes.
So we're sitting there, and I get home, I said to her, we've got the car ready to go. All the stuff is packed the night before. I get home at 11 o'clock. I want to be on the road by 12 because it's 2 hours. You leave at 12:30, 1 o'clock, it's 3 and a half. Well, she wouldn't get in the car. Where are we going? I said, we're going to the Catskills. And this went on for an hour and a half. I finally said, I'm out of here. She reluctantly got in the car. We're driving out the driveway. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, I said, and I looked at her. And like, I said to her privately, I said, you better go see the doctor and get these pills changed because this ain't working, okay? So she, we're driving out the door. We're going up the road about 25 miles an hour. I hear, I hear a noise. My daughter, my youngest screams, and my wife, I see her rolling on the ground. She jumped out of the car at 25 miles an hour.
How horrifying for everyone.
I just stopped the car. I got out, and I looked at her. I'm like, I looked at her, and I said, we're going to the doctor right now. This is not right, okay? She gets back. She gets in the car. She's like, don't take me to the doctor. I promise I won't take my medications. Okay? So I said, fine. We get back in the car. Now it's a three-hour ordeal to get to the mountains. We hit all this weekend traffic. You got to go to the New York State Thruway to Route 17, and it's just a kebab. Okay? So we get there at 5:30. We go tubing down the river. I don't see anything all weekend. I'm with her all weekend long. Not one weird incident.
Right. So she was fine, and you're still thinking that this is having
menopause.
To do with menopause, yeah.
Yes, correct. So about a week later, I'm trying, maybe it was a week and a half later, there were some things. I get a couple more phone calls from the kids. And on the Sunday before she was involuntarily taken from her home, I was reading the Sunday Daily Record or the Star Ledger. I forget which Sunday paper it was because I only get the papers on Sunday, okay? And on the front page shows a boy by the name of Jack Leminski, okay, a 12-year-old boy in Basking Ridge, one town over from New Vernon, okay? And it said, the article stated the mother suffocated her 12-year-old son. Now, in the article, which was there, they stated that the mother, the father, they were divorced or separated, I don't know, and the oldest daughter was 17, living with him, and the younger boy was 11 at the time, and a judge ordered that he stayed with the mother. The father said the woman had mental health issues. Well, basically, she suffocated and tried to slit her wrists. They found her and saved her, okay? And I read this, and a knot went off in my stomach, and I went, oh, my God, I hope it's just menopause, or could this be something worse? And I started thinking about the door and some incidents and things like that, and I'm going, I hope and pray that this is menopause. And I said, that's it. And so she walked into the room, in the dining room that evening, about 8:30, and she says, what are you reading? And I said, no, nothing. I tried to put it away. And she saw the article. She looked at it, started to read it, and in a very odd tone, because the light switch was starting to go, said to me, I would never do something like that. And I'm like, whoa, this is now my gut's going. So I go to bed.
Understandable.
I go to bed. I'm tossing and turning. Like, I can't. She's somewhere else. I get up in the morning about 6:30. And that Sunday we had to clean Leslie's room up because a new bed was being delivered. And she had one of those, when we first moved to the house, Pam, we had my mother-in-law in the house, and we had only three bedrooms because we converted the fourth to an office for Sandy.
Okay.
So we had one of those kind of units where you can put two beds and there's a client, they climb up and they, you know,
sure.
One's 5 feet off the ground. Yeah. So we had taken that out. It was a kiddie room, and Leslie was now 12 and going to be 13, wanted a teenage room.
Of course. She
was so we ordered a new bed and it was being delivered Monday. So I cleaned the room up the day before. This is on that Sunday. And at the end of the night, read this article. So I wake up the next morning and I'm looking for my wife. She's not in the bedroom. She's not on the couch somewhere. Maybe she's up in the barn. I go to the barn. There's nothing. The barn's a mess. And I'm like, what's going on out here? And
Bill,
then I find my wife.
Bill, I'm going to interrupt you because we need to take a break. But when we come back, I want to pick up right there with where you found your wife, what was going on.
Okay.
All right. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. And I'm having a conversation with William P. Dunn IV, who is the author of Sandy's Gift, Walking with the Light. We'll be right back. Bill, on the back cover of Sandy's Gift, Walking with the Light, the book that we're discussing, which of course is your life, is described as an autobiography based on true events and life-changing experiences. I wonder on that day that you were looking for your wife, if you had any idea about the upcoming life-changing experiences your household was about to experience.
On that day, no. So let me go back to where we left off. So
sure.
I walked around the house and I looked on. I finally opened Leslie, Jenny's door, sitting over there. I found my daughters in my daughter's room. Leslie was asleep on the mattress on the floor. What I saw next to my daughter curled up on the floor was my wife on the floor. Dog is on a leash next to her, and they're asleep. So I go to work. And I'm like, at this point, the first thing I did is I called Dr. Berger's office, which is a family doctor, which barely we went to because I never get sick. I'm fortunate. And I played phone tag that day on Monday. Well, the following Tuesday, I finally got through to somebody. And I said, listen, there's some oddball things going on. And I know Sandy's been down there seeing you and she's being treated for menopause. And I got to talk to you. And they said, what are you talking about? We haven't seen your wife in years. And I said, she's been telling me she's been seeing you about menopause. And I spoke with Dr. Berger's wife, Sandy, who ran the office, and I described a few of these things. And she says, come on. She goes, come in tomorrow morning. So I went in the next morning, and I spoke with them about what was going on.
You know, let me interrupt you for 1 second, because I'm wondering if, as I think about HIPAA regulations and all that, which basically don't allow anybody to talk to anybody without permission, if you hadn't been speaking to, number one, the family doctor who you'd known for years, and number two, the doctor's wife, who may or may not have had the same awareness of privacy issues, I wonder if you would have gotten any information at all.
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know that, because here's what happened. I started to describe the sequence of events, and they said, listen, she needs to see, get her to the hospital, get her to the emergency room, and if she won't go, they said to me, don't force her. And I said, why? And they said, because she can have you arrested for kidnapping. I'm not like, what are you talking about? And I found out this is true, basically. So what happened was I said to Sandy that Wednesday evening, listen, I've made an arrangement for you to go tomorrow afternoon to go get a blood draw. And I was hoping and praying that this was just a hormonal imbalance, you know, whatever.
Sure.
And that Wednesday night, for hours on end, she talked to me about how she didn't need to go to the hospital. This was for 5.5 hours, okay? I had appointments all day. I canceled one at the end of the day as a financial advisor. I said, Sandy, I've made arrangements to go to a doctor. She goes to me, well, I said, Sandy, you've been lying to me. You told me you've been seeing Dr. Berger. You haven't been there in years. I went to them. She goes, what are you talking about? I said, I went to the doctor's office. So I come home early. She won't go. That next morning, I get up. I go to Dr. Berger's office. I said, what do I do? She won't go. They said, try it one more time. Try to get her to go. If she doesn't go, go see the police. So I come back from the office. I said, Sandy, we got to go to the doctor's office. You got another appointment scheduled for 3 o'clock today. I'm not going to go. So with that, I walk downstairs to the den, her office. I pick up the phone. I dial the police, 911. And she's like, who are you calling? I said, I'm calling the police because you won't go to a doctor. I said, you need to go. There's something wrong here. I go, you jumped from a moving vehicle 2 weeks ago, a car. I said, if another car had been coming, you could have been killed. I said, you could have caused an accident here. I said, there's something wrong with you. And I said, you just need to go see a doctor to get a blood thing and maybe change your prescription on your medication. Now, I didn't tell her. I knew she was lying, you know, that she wasn't on anything at that point. So long story short is that she refused to go. So the police come. They're there for 2 hours. They took knives. She had a penknife in her possession, all sorts of sharp objects. I'm sitting there crying, please get in the car with me. She would walk into the car and get this look of terror would appear on her face, and she wouldn't get in. And the cops couldn't make her. And this is exactly what happened 2 weeks prior to me trying to get her, convince her to go in the car with me to go up to the Catskills with the kids to go tubing for the weekend. So after 2.5 hours, the cops leave, and I'm like, what the heck do I do now? And I finally said to the last cop, he said, I'm getting out of here. I said, because this is, and he goes, don't leave her alone. I'm like, okay. Well, long story short was later on, My daughter disclosed to us that her mother, that morning that I went in to see her, I didn't see, in her hand, when Leslie woke up, her mother was laying next on the ground next to her bed with a 14-inch carving knife resting between her two hands put together under her chin. That's how my 12-year-old daughter woke up. Now, this is, mind you, the day after I had read this article on Sunday evening, and she said, and I'd never do anything like that, read the article. God knows what was in her mind. I don't know. Okay? So eventually she was involuntarily taken to St. Clair's Hospital up in Denville, New Jersey. The whole time she was there, she was non-cooperative, okay? Turned out one of her friends was there. I didn't even know, but this woman had been going through the same issues for years, and I didn't even know it was a friend of hers because I saw her one day there. She was non-cooperative, and when I finally got with this litigation I filed, I finally found out she was on a suicide watch the whole time she was there.
Did you know that?
I knew nothing. Absolutely nothing. Sandy, we had planned to go to the Outer Banks the week later, a week after. She was taken away on a Friday. The following Friday, we were to head to another vacation to go to the Outer Banks with the kids. Now, we were supposed to go to the Delaware County Fair. That got canceled that weekend because of her being locked up, which is something the kids went to every year up in the Catskills for 4 days. And I'm sitting there hemming and hawing. My wife's in the hospital for a week. She won't sign forms so the doctors can tell me anything. I went to a joint session on the Tuesday after she was involuntarily taken in which she continued to interrupt me. And Dr., I think it was Patel, if my recollection is correctly, asked us questions, and we were supposed to each to answer. About 10 minutes into this thing, she's jabbering on and on and interrupting me, and Dr. Patel says, Ms. Zahn, if you don't be quiet, this session's over. So he asked me another question. I said, Sandy, you're here for a reason. You jumped from a car, but I go, you were sleeping next to your daughter with a carving knife and a dog on a leash. Suppose there was a noise that spooked you, or the dog bark. What were you going to do? She didn't have an answer. She starts interrupting as I'm telling, and the doctor finally says, that's it, the disappointment's over. I went, what? You know, so he goes out. I said, doctor, I said, look, doctor, I said, you know, this is, I said, I mean, I said to him, I said, look, my wife signed forms. What is she? I said, I asked him a question. He goes, I can't refer you to answer it. I said, doctor, my wife told me this morning she signed the forms. He says, she hasn't signed anything. She's in denial of why she's here. That's what he said to me. So the whole time Sandy was in this hospital, she refused to sign forms that would allow them to talk to me about her condition.
All right, so
this Privacy Act within HIPAA.
Let me just pull back on that for a second, because I really want the listeners to understand, to feel what you were going through. Your wife has been taken to the hospital, to a psychiatric facility. She's in a locked ward. Your mm-hmm. daughters and you have no idea what's going on. You have no
Correct.
Idea of a diagnosis. You have no idea of medication, if any. You have no idea that she's on a suicide watch. And
none whatsoever.
And the privacy laws, which you know, were conceived to help people maintain their privacy, in this instance, absolutely. How would you describe how the privacy laws affected your family in this instance?
The privacy laws are tragically flawed. The privacy law within this act, they're good for look, I understand why they're placed there, first off. Suppose you have a drug problem or you're an alcoholic and you go to a rehab place and clean yourself up. That should be there because people are going to start over and start fresh, okay?
Right.
And give them a secondary chance in life. And that's why that's my personal belief why that portion of the law was done, okay? But the unintended consequence, Doctor or Pam, is that with that same thing, if you have an 18-year-old child who's a senior in high school and they're on medication, or you have a spouse and they don't want to sign anything, because generally with mental health, the person's not in the right mind to begin with, okay? You don't know what's going on. Okay, so here I'm a guy, I'm paying the insurance bills, I'm paying all this stuff, I don't get to know. And I did say this, I've said this on every interview. Rosie O'Donnell, who's a very well-known person, okay, actress and talk show host,
mm-hmm.
she has a daughter, she left The View, and she announced in the middle of February of 2016 she was leaving The View. citing personal family matters. She left the View on February 28th. All right? She's in August of 2016, I forget the date, early August, she went public trying to locate her 17-year-old daughter who had taken the dog and disappeared with mental health issues. Okay? Now, eventually the daughter was found in Brick, New Jersey. Okay? If the daughter, and the daughter was 17, if the daughter's 18, now guess what? Her hands are tied. Completely tied. Okay? So the unintended consequence with this act, and as I wrote in the book in 1996, is that families and family members have no control, nor can they get their loved one help if the loved one doesn't need it. And as I wrote in this, we continue to see increased shootings throughout the nation, at schools, at theaters. We just had one down here in Fort Lauderdale on June 6th, okay? This is what I believe is the unintended consequences. You cannot get these people help, all right? And as I said, you know, look, I lived in the wealthiest zip code in New Jersey. At the time of Sandy's passing, and I was poor compared to some there, but I'm a pretty well-off man, New Vernon, New Jersey was ranked as the 23rd wealthiest zip code. So if it can happen to me, and it can happen to Rosie O'Donnell, and it can happen to Senator Craig Deaves, a state senator in Virginia whose son tried to kill him, and he survived, and he was interviewed on 60 Minutes, this has to be addressed, okay? Because there will continue to be shootings down at airports and everywhere else, and innocent people will be slaughtered. And it goes, it's become so commonplace, okay? Everybody originally thought this shooting down at Fort Lauderdale Airport was a terrorist act. The moment they found out it was a crazy person, it disappeared. Oh, we're used to it. We're expecting it now. This shouldn't be the norm. Does that make sense or not sense?
Well, you know, it shouldn't be the norm. It seems to me that if you've got a loved one, but then it gets complicated. If you've got a loved one in care and you're just trying to figure out what's going on, it seems to me that you have a right to at least get the diagnosis, if nothing else. One of the problems that can arise is if you're in an abusive situation and the abuser is trying to get information, that can actually be used to harm the client even more. There's another piece, which is that, you know, the bias is that the myth is that most of the killings or the shootings are done by quote unquote crazy people. And that's actually not true. The majority of people who are deemed to have a mental health issue are more likely to be victims than to be criminals. But again, it gets so complicated because, as I understand it, the diagnosis that your wife had, you later learned was she was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, right?
I believe that was the case because, okay. See, I didn't know. So here we are, we're going through all this stuff. So what happens is I take the kids away. I'm calling the hospital. I find out that the day that I finally left, the following Saturday, we got down to the Outer Banks, okay, of North Carolina. She had finally verbally agreed, they had everything recorded. So she finally verbally agreed that they could call me at the hospital. And I said, well, look, we're down here. And then I found out that her hearing was going to be set the following Friday. So we left the Thursday, got home. I called her that night and she's like, how you doing? I said, oh, well, we're home. I said to her, I said, listen, can I come visit you tomorrow? Now, I know that her hearing is tomorrow because I've got the piece of paper saying it, and the clinician said her hearing is tomorrow.
And what was the hearing for?
The hearing was in the state of New Jersey, when someone is involuntarily committed against their own wishes, there must be a hearing 20 or 21 days.
Okay.
And in that hearing, basically a judgment, the judge basically, it's a rubber stamp saying, okay, the person needs to go to a new facility. Okay. So I went to I went that morning on Friday at 10 o'clock to show up. And she said to me, she goes, oh, well, visitations are only Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. I said, well, can I come by? It's been a week. I want to tell you about the trip. So she goes, no, you got to come Saturday. So I kept my mouth shut. So I arrived the next day on Friday about 10 o'clock for the hearings, which started somewhere around 11. And I got there and then she saw me and they go, well, she wants to talk with you. And she's like, why are you here? And I said, well, Sandy, I have a letter here. You have a court hearing today. She looked at me like, why are you doing this to me? I said, Sandy, I love you. You need help. We need to figure out what's wrong with you. Okay. So long story short is she gets very upset. distrustful of my motives, needless to say. I'm sitting in the waiting room. The clinician comes in. Colleen Lopez comes out to me. She goes, Mr. Dunn, she's not going to allow your hearing. I'm like, what are you talking about? I said, I have a letter here from the court saying she has a hearing. I can't be present. And she goes, well, she has the right to prohibit you from the hearing. I go, why? I looked at her. Is it this HIPAA law again? She goes, yes. She goes, don't worry about it. The doctors are going to say that she needs to go to a long-term facility. Go home, start making arrangements. We'll take care of it. I get home, okay, expecting a phone call at 5 o'clock. I get one at 3. And Judge Robert J. Brennan of New Jersey overruled doctors and let her back into the house. I would later find out from the court transcripts that the evidence, police reports, my daughter's oral dissertation to both Dyfus and police that her mother was sleeping next to her with a 14-inch carving knife, he considered them inadmissible evidence in his court of law. Sandy was ill. She requested a public attorney. It was a woman. Public attorney says these are inadmissible. This is hearsay evidence. He supported this view, and he let her back into the house with one precondition, that she can't be in the house alone, and DIFAS, the Division of Youth and Family Services, or I call them the Destruction of Youth and a Family, thank you for their service in the book, was to monitor the household.
Okay,
nothing.
Let me ask you a question, though, because I'm getting kind of stuck on the diagnosis that you later understood to be true. If, in fact, she was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, aside from the fact that that's probably one of the most difficult illnesses to effectively treat, aside from the fact that someone who's paranoid is likely to be noncompliant with mostly everything, aside from the fact that someone with that diagnosis is likely not to follow through on much of anything, it's unclear to me how the judge, even with a passing understanding of mental health issues, would see paranoid schizophrenia and think that A, it was okay for her to be home, and B, that she was going to a home where you had the clinical competency to monitor her 24/7. I don't get any of that.
Quite frankly, I don't either. Okay. And so as I described Judge Brennan, he's my family's Osama bin Laden. He's my most wanted terrorist. And as I wrote in the book, I've taken my pen rather than my sword to slay the dragon of my past. Okay? I want the world to know what that man did. Plus a few police officers in New Jersey, plus the DIFAS people who shredded documents and falsified things. So
shredded documents.
Oh yeah, We'll get to that later on. So anyway, she's let out of the hospital. It's somewhat tolerable. She was supposed to start outpatient treatment on Tuesday. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, she didn't go. I said to her Thursday night, if you don't go, I'm calling the hospital and the clinician, just like they said. She reluctantly went.
Was she supposed to go once a week or daily?
It was supposed to go daily, outpatient,
right,
to Morristown.
Intensive outpatient.
It was 5 minutes from our house. Okay,
So
what happens is, on September 13th, I forget what day of the week that was, a girl by the name of Irmaine Remy from the Division of Youth and Family Services comes to the house. She's asking questions, and she's got to come every 2 weeks, she says. So she's scheduled to come on the 27th. And in that time period, Sandy continued to get the behavior was off. It wasn't right. So I went to the hospital to go talk to her clinician on the same day, the 27th of September, that Irmaine Remy is supposed to show up from the state. Early in the morning, get there about 8 o'clock. The girl, Roseanne Misclone, was the outpatient clinician. She said she wasn't there. So Dr. Contini, who ran the outpatient facility, psychiatric area of this area for Morristown Memorial Hospital, spoke with me. And I said, Dr. Contini, I said, this isn't working. I said, there's something wrong here. I go, she's not right. And he looked at me, he goes, your wife shouldn't be here, Bill. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, she's very ill. I said, well, maybe she could have, he goes, she may never work again. I go, what are you talking about? And then I went, I know, you can't tell me. Because of the HIPAA law, because probably there's a form that she had to sign that she obviously refused to sign, like she did in the hospital. And I said, would you do me a favor, doctor? Please call DIFAS. He said, she shouldn't be here. She should be in a long-term facility to monitor, and hopefully with the proper drugs and treatments, she could get better. That's what he says to me.
Yeah.
I said, please call our DIFAS rep. She's due to arrive today. He called her. She left a message. She never called him back, I found out in court later on with the litigation we filed. So I'm left here stranded with a woman in a house who's not right, kids withdrawing from their mom, trying to maintain a household. I still don't even know what she's in there for. Got it? And as I said to earlier on NPR the other day, Sandy was like Gale Sayers, the greatest running back in the world. She raised a family. She took care of her mom. She did all these things, was active in the school and the PTO, all these things. And it was as if in a very short period of time, she got chop blocked. And, you know, we don't know the causes for mental illness. Maybe she fell off one of her horses, got an injury to the head. I don't know, okay? However, we went through all these issues, and it's the end of September, end of October, middle of October, we had a joint session between Leslie and her mother and me, and basically it was no means no, Mommy. She was treating her children like infants. They were withdrawing.
Bill,
we had a family.
Bill, yes, I have to interrupt you. We have to take a break. But when we come back, we're for the sake of time, we're going to need to fast forward to the litigation to give folks a sense of what you actually went through. And let's make it clear, your wife ultimately committed suicide.
Yes, that's correct.
We'll be right back, folks. Your story is unfortunately so painful and so frustrating because HIPAA, as you've said, HIPAA laws are in place to protect. And in fact, in some instances, they do anything but. As we said just before the break, your wife ultimately committed suicide. And what is your sense of why?
I don't know. Basically, she was ill. I mean, and, you know, I've tried to sort this out. Victor Rotolo handed it. He said, well, perhaps she thought you were going to leave her. I don't know. Okay. I don't have an answer because I'll know that when I leave this world. Okay. I'll know the final answer. Okay. When I go to the next world. So basically she passes away. I kept thinking something was wrong, okay? And I talked to a couple of people, and finally I followed my intuition. I talked to one attorney through a mutual friend, and it turned out this gentleman was a prosecutor for mental health, and he grilled me like I was a criminal, saying, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you call the police? I said, I did all these things.
Right.
I don't think he believed the story. Then I met a man by the name of Victor Rotolo through a mutual friend at a fly fishing show in Somerset, New Jersey. And John was a police officer, and he said, Bill, he says, I'm a police officer. He says, what? And I said, how you guys doing? I haven't seen you in a while. And I go, well, I used to go to the show every year. So I show up, and he says, how you doing? I said, I have some unfortunate news. Sandy passed away. What happened? Because I used to travel. He used to trout fish with me and Sandy. And I kind of gave him, I said, let's go get a Coke next door. I told him the story. He says, I'm a police officer. He says, something's wrong here. He says, I'm telling you, somehow the Harding Township police are involved with this thing. Well, ultimately, I found out he was right.
How so?
So he gave me this. What I found out after Rotolo with his investigation is I went to the police on the right after the Tuesday after Sandy was released. I took the kids because I said, I got to go to the school. I talked to both teachers, the principal saying she can't. I talked to the grammar school teacher, principal, who gave me a bunch of crap. And I said, listen, if you let my wife pick up my daughter and something happens, I'll make sure you never work again in a school the rest of your life. I was really that pissed off. The high school principal was fine. And so later on, what I was found, I went to the police, the chief of police, Kevin Gaffney, and said, listen, a judge has overruled doctors. You guys were here that day. She was taken away because she was sleeping next to her door with a carving knife. I want my guns out of the house. They're over with Scott Noyce behind here. Because by law in New Jersey, if you remove your guns from your household, you have to notify the police of who and where. So I did.
Okay.
Because I didn't want them in the house, even though they have safety locks. I had shotguns I used to bird on. Okay? So they're out. After all the issues that happened, I went to see the police on October 31st. I saw the same chief of police and said, listen, I'm really concerned here. This isn't working. She won't do this. She won't do that. He said there was nothing they could do. I then went to the police on two more occasions, reaching out after the clinicians. She wouldn't show up, said go see them. And it's in the book. What I later found out, according to Dyfus records, someone in the Harding Township Police, somewhere in November, when I was reaching out, she was no longer medicated. She was no longer showing for outpatient therapy. Someone in the Harding Township Police Department told the state representatives he's filing for her divorce and trying to get the upper hand and custody of the children. That's what was said behind my back by these. I don't even want to talk about the boys in blue up there. I'll be polite about it.
Thank you.
I think of them.
Okay.
Okay. I think they should keep that picture in the Capitol building, by the way. Okay.
Okay.
That's all I got to say.
Okay.
okay. Now, so here I am. I find this out. Okay. Dyfus showed up on September 13th. Every 2 weeks they were supposed to show. The girl didn't show up on the 27th. She didn't show up again. I'm calling them going, what's going on? Out of desperation on October 31st, after Roseanne McClone said to me, whispered, the caseworker, this is the first time I heard this from anybody. She had the door was closed. She whispered to me. She goes, I said, I'm ready to take the kids and get out of here. They're asking me to leave and get them out of a house because it's so crazy. She says to me, Roseanne says, don't leave her. I think she might be suicidal. They knew this all along. This is the first time I'm hearing this. So I go to the police that day and say, listen, I'm being told she's suicidal. What do I do here? The chief of police does nothing. Now, there's all, the two meetings that I had with Kevin Gaffney, there is no police record for that. Seems a little bit odd to me. I don't know.
There's no record of the meeting you had
with
the
police? There's no record of me going there telling him I took my guns from the house. There's no record of me going on the 31st of October saying she might be suicidal. There's no record of that. You ask me why, okay? I regret that I didn't file litigation now against the Harding Township cops for slander. I should have. Anyway, so after I read all these things years later, they finally, I didn't get the transfers from the police for 4 years because Victor wouldn't give them to me because he was afraid I'd probably go down to my guns and take a few of them out.
let me ask you this. What I am wondering is, it's truly speculation, but if in fact your wife called the police and told them that you were just trying to get the upper hand, it is conceivable, number one, that she would do that, because if in fact she was paranoid, that's what paranoid folks do.
Yep.
It is conceivable that if she did that, sounded like she was in a sane place, they would believe it, and they would assume that you were somehow harming her in order to get the better of her, and that could explain a lot of the stuff that it seems like they ignored.
I've thought that too, Pam. I've thought that. However, there's no police report of her going down there doing that. Got it?
She might have called.
I don't know. Listen, yeah, I can't tell you because in the month of November, there was a safety order. She's sitting outside when Leslie got home when field hockey ended in a running car going for 2 hours waiting for me to come home. So I don't know what was said. I later found out from one of her friends, she told her we had no money. I'm like, and I said, lady, I said, I can come up with 7 digits in 3 business days. She didn't know what that was. I said, six starts at 100,000. She was shocked. So I don't know what was being said by my ill woman, my wife behind my back. But the police were there when they were told that she was, it's in the police report. She's got knives in her possession when they took her away. Come on. It's in the police reports we're providing the back of the book. So basically what happened was ultimately I filed the litigation. And what we did is originally it was against Dyfus, the Harding Township Police. They listed Morristown Memorial, the outpatient, and they also listed the public defender. Now, this is what's really ironic. The woman who was Sandy's public defender, almost a year to the day after Sandy's passing, she committed suicide. Go figure that one out.
Interesting.
So I have a crazy lady representing my crazy wife. I can't connect the dots if I try, as I say.
What happened with the litigation?
What's that?
What happened with the litigation?
Eventually, we settled it. I won an arbitration. It took 6 years. Okay.
Six years.
I found was Dyfus falsified reports. They cut and shredded documents. They were deposed. They didn't even show up for depositions twice. If I did that, I'd be hauled away to jail.
True.
You know, it's If I'm ordered to go to court for deposition and I don't show up, the police are at my house the next day to take me away, right?
What about the judge?
Well, the judge, believe it or not, now this even gets better. So here we are. The judge lets her out. In November, I actually, in November, the beginning of November, when I found out she was suicidal, I was actually told by an attorney, after Roseanne said, I think she may be suicidal, go see an attorney. I go see an attorney. He says, go to the judge's chambers. I sat outside this man's all day long on November 7th and was turned away at 4:50 in the afternoon by his assistant. She said, why are you here? I told him. He came in for lunch. I waited. At 4:50, she was called into his chambers. He came back out. He said, he's too busy to see you. I wanted to break his door down. Now I regret I didn't, okay? But I had two children, and if I'd done that, I'd been arrested, hauled off to jail, and I'd have my wife at home with my two children that's ill, suicidal, et cetera.
It's true.
So guess what? Guess what? This gets better, the chain of dots. The judge who let my wife out, Robert J. Brennan, gets assigned our litigation when we finally pass, which is when we finally file litigation. 5 years, he signs his name off to any extension anybody wants, never reading, 2 days before the actual the summary judgment where you have to request permission to sue the government and present a case, he withdraws himself from the case. On August 15th, he withdraws himself the case on August 13th of 2006. I'm already in Florida permanently now.
Okay, let me ask you a question, because I'm kind of stuck. And I'm sure I misheard you. I'm sure that you did not say that the judge who let your wife out to return home is the same judge who was assigned to the arbitration and signing off on extensions. He is
assigned our case. And I told Rotolo, I never want to see that son of a, you know what. And because I felt the cover of a curse. So for 5 years, he signed his name to everything and never even read what he was signing. Connect the dots.
I'm
Pam.
Speechless.
Connect the dots.
Yeah, I'm speechless.
Yeah.
I know you were. This was your whole life.
Yeah. So anyway, eventually we won. Now, the weirdest thing was a year and a half after Sandy passed, I went to an appointment, and this is where the spirituality comes in here. I go to my accountant, his name is Brian Corcoran. I'd handle his mother's investments. I'm good with this. I'm very good at what I do, okay? So he calls me up and he says, Bill, my aunt Catherine, she's getting divorced. She's a canon of the Catholic Church. She's getting a large check. He says, I want you to put some money in something safe for her so her kids can't get at it because they're going to be scoffing at the bid to try to get money from her. And this is her entire life savings. So I go to this appointment, 28th of April, of 2008, and she brings a friend with her. The woman's name is Gloria. She's got short crop red hair. She's in her mid-50s, I'm guessing. Maybe, and Catherine's in her... I'd say she's in her later 50s and Catherine's in her mid to late 60s, okay? They're very good friends. And Gloria says to me, she goes, well, Bill, I'm here because I call her my Aunt Catherine. I've known her for years. And she goes, I want to make sure everything's okay. We go through this two-hour appointment. I don't think anything's going to be done. This woman keeps asking me questions, Pam. And I'm finally like, it's not going to be done. Well, long story short, $250,000 gets invested. She says to me after the appointment, Gloria said, Bill, we need to go to a room where I can close the door. I want to ask you something. So we go to this room. She starts talking to me. She says, do you know what a medium is? I said, no, I don't know what that is. So she says to me, I'm a medium. I see people who have gone from beyond. Your wife was behind you through this whole appointment, waving her hands, saying, pointing her fingers at me, going, tell them, tell them, tell them, tell them. So she starts to tell me these things. I break down and cry. Okay? I finally gather my thoughts. I said, can I take your phone number? I go back to the bank, a friend of mine, Brian Lang, who I'd ate sushi with the week before, and we're talking. I said, you know, Brian, I never met a redhead. I saw a redhead, fell in love with her, blah, blah, blah. I leave the appointment. I go back to the bank. The first person I see is this guy who was a friend of mine, and he says, Bill, you look like you've seen a ghost. I said, Brian, I just talked with one. And I take him next door. We have a Coke, and I tell him what, and he's like, oh, my God, spooky. I say, no, hocus pocus. About 3 weeks later, and this woman said to me.
So you didn't really believe it then?
No, never,
okay.
Never,
okay.
Never. I call it hocus. I call the part of the book Hocus Pocus.
Right.
So 3 weeks later, I pick up the phone. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to call this lady. I pick up the phone. She's there. It didn't ring. I didn't dial the tone. I didn't plug the number in. She's like, hi, Bill. How you doing? I have to tell you something. Sandy came to me, and she's got a couple messages to you. And I went, okay, after hearing this. So she tells me one story about, she tells me a bunch of things. She says, well, Leslie needs to get the blue dress. And I go, what blue dress? She goes, she's going to a dance and she needs to get the blue strapless dress for the dance. That's what your wife wants to get. So I go, okay, Gloria. So a couple of weeks later, about a week later, my daughter, my youngest daughter is graduating eighth grade. And she goes, Dad, I need to get a white dress for graduation and I'll wear that to the dance. And I go, what dance? She goes, the cotillion, which is a dance in a formal catering hall for eighth grade little boys and girls from the area in different schools, you know? I'm like, I paid for this in either September or beginning of October. I forgot I wrote the check. So a couple weeks later after that, we go to Macy's one day. I'm cutting the grass. They say to her, can you come out and help me cut the grass? She had a difficult day. It was a Monday evening. She apparently had to go through all the photographs and the albums, and it was very difficult for her because it was a school thing, bringing sure. pictures of your families and all that.
Bill, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're just about out of time.
Okay, so basically, this woman, Gloria, it's in the book, as you know. I would later find out I met not a local hocus pocus lazy, but a world-renowned medium. Her name is Gloria Wyken. She's been interviewed by Tom Brokaw, Rosie O'Donnell, Oprah Winfrey, Glamour Magazine Woman of the Year, and I had to rewrite part of the book after I found this out in 2015. So it's kind of bizarre. I've written this because there's many families, Pam, who I'm not afraid to share my story because I've gotten messages from beyond. I've been blessed that way. And I said to Leslie, your mother loved me so much, she found me. I didn't seek out the medium, okay? And I wrote this because I don't want any other family, any other little boy or girl, to go through what my family went through, okay? And I can only imagine what happens to other families that don't have the resources that I had.
Exactly.
Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it just what was done, and I call them the public disservice in New Jersey. You know, so everything's in the book. The publisher was like, aren't you afraid of a litigation? I was like, no, I wrote the truth. What are they going to do, sue me? I said, if any one of them tries to sue me, I'm just going to call Bertola, file a counter litigation, and I'll take everything they ever worked all their lives for because they took it from me as far as I'm concerned. Got it?
Absolutely. Your life forever changed. And who's
Absolutely.
Who's to say? What it would have been like if you had known what was going on.
My good friend Craig Curtis said to me, he says, you know, Bill, the saddest thing about this whole thing, and as I write this, the saddest part is Sandy was never given an opportunity to get better.
Right.
I can't say she would have, and I can't say, Pam, and this I will say this here, I can't tell you whether it would have been worse if she survived, and every Mother's Day her children had to go see her in an institution for the rest of their lives.
Right.
I don't have that answer.
Right.
You got it?
Absolutely.
And I have to accept, and as I wrote in the book, I've come to learn to accept what God chose for me. I had 20 years with a great woman. Most people don't get to 5 from what I see in the world out there, okay? I had 20. And, you know, 257 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer. 40,000 will die this year. There's 15 million adults age 18 and up with a severe form of mental illness. 26.2% of 270 million, according to Bureau of Mental Health, have health issues, 1 in 4. So I'm willing to talk about this to try to make some change for the public good. Because as I wrote, if just one little boy or girl or family is spared what we went through, then Sandy's passing is not in vain. It may sound noble and holy, but maybe I believe into a higher power. I do. Okay?
William P. Dunn IV, author of Sandy's Gift, Walking with the Light. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Thank you for the time, Pam.
And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, and I hope you are, the email is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And when you send in your email, let me know where in the world you are listening to Mind Talk. Thanks so much again, folks, and remember always, if it is unacceptable, that is exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.